What Iran is doing is providing an example, not just to the countries which are allied with China and Russia, but to countries like my own native Canada, where intelligent people can see what's happening, finally.
All right. And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Shabir Razvi, political analyst out of London. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran and Indonesia declare a decision to use the two countries' national currencies in bilateral trade, ditching the U.S. dollar. A new report says Israel has demolished nearly 120 Palestinian homes across the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. And Russia says its fighter jet has intercepted 2 U.S. strategic bombers over the Baltic Sea, preventing them from violating the country's border. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. In our top story, the Iranian president says Tehran and Jakarta are set to dramatically raise their bilateral trade exchanges.
The goal we have set for the development of economic and trade relations between the two countries is to reach the tune of $20 billion.
Ebrahim Raisi added the two countries have agreed to use their own national currencies in trade. He made the remarks in a joint presser following a meeting with his Indonesian counterpart, Joko Widodo, in Jakarta. Two leaders announced plans to boost economic cooperation, particularly in the field of energy. Both sides have signed 11 cooperation agreements, including on customs and pharmaceuticals, as well as oil and gas, among others. Raisi is on an official visit to Indonesia as part of Iran's policy of pivoting to Asia and cementing cooperation with Muslim nations. Professor Mohammad Marandi from the University of Tehran says a decline in Western power and a rising Asia has prompted countries like Indonesia to move closer to Iran.
ASEAN is very important and Indonesia is extremely important in ASEAN, and the whole of Asia is on the rise. Jakarta is a very different city from what it was a decade ago, and with the changing political landscape that we see across the globe, it only makes sense for Iran and Indonesia to rethink their policies, their economic policies, their trade relationship with one another under these new circumstances. The leverage that the Americans and the Europeans have continues to decline, and that makes the Indonesians more open to defy those policies. And of course, since Iran and Russia are completing a north-south transport corridor, like India, which has good relations with Indonesia, and China too, the Indonesian government has an added incentive to do business or increase its business relationship with Iran. Specifically, like India, Jakarta can make use of this north-south transport corridor. So it's not just enhancing trade and business with Iran and, of course, political relations, but also it is an opening to Central Asia and Russia.
Now, the 51st edition of the Asian Clearing Union Summit is underway in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Reducing dependency on the U.S. dollar is the agenda of the meeting being held at the Central Bank of Iran. Now, apart from top banking officials of member states, the governor of the Russian Central Bank is attending the two-day conference. We're now going to swing over to our correspondent, Gisu Misha Ahmadi, who is president at the venue, for more on the story. Hello, Gisu. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. What's this meeting all about, and what does it signify?
Well, basically what you said was the gist of what the whole entire meeting, the 51st meeting of the Board of Governors, is all about. De-dollarization is high on the agenda. And Danny, this might seem like a new concept, but let's not forget that the ACU was established in 1974 with the aim of providing an opportunity for the member states to use their own monetary system in order to do business transactions. So it is not a new concept, but 50 years later, we see that the political scene and the new world order that is emerging is providing the groundwork for this to actually happen.
And Gisu, when we're talking about this being the 51st edition, has Iran been a part of this from its very onset, or is it a new member belonging to this group?
Well, yes, Iran was a member from the very start when it was established in 1974 with a number of regional countries, including India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal. But what's happened today, and something that will be discussed later during the day, is devising a mechanism to accept new members into the ACU. And we have three observer member states that are present today: Russia, Belarus, and Afghanistan are present today. And if the member states agree, these countries might also join the ACU.
And Gisu, before we let you go, why is de-dollarization these days and countries using their own national currencies in bilateral transactions gaining so much traction?
And the increasing interest of investors in instruments such as green or sustainability bonds.
This is more and more, as you mentioned yourself, Danny, becoming an interesting concept for not just countries that have been sanctioned by the United States, but countries across the world, including the ACU member states, because it's making it more easier for business transactions to be made. And, of course, right before we had this report with you, this live report, the vice president of Iran delivered a speech, Mr. Mohber, and these are the key issues that he pointed out. The fact that U.S. sanctions have devalued the dollar itself across the world, it is no longer a dependent currency, it is not considered a dependable currency, and therefore countries are trying to move away as much as they can from the dollar. And like I said, this does not include only countries that have been sanctioned by the United States, like Iran, but also other states are doing the same.
Hi, Gisu. Thank you, and we'll check in with you later. Enjoy the summit there. Gisu Misha Ahmadi there, joining us from the Iranian capital. And now, meanwhile, a new report says Israel has demolished nearly 120 Palestinian homes across the occupied West Bank since the beginning of this year. According to a Palestinian data center, 9 demolished buildings belong to families of Palestinian prisoners and those killed in anti-Israeli operations. Demolitions took place in several cities, including Al-Quds, Ramallah, Jenin, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Israel has been stepping up a crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The regime demolishes homes of Palestinians under numerous pretexts, including lack of permits and retaliation for anti-Israeli operations. Thousands of strong protests against Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu show no signs of abating, and now demonstrators have taken to the streets accusing Netanyahu of granting a lot of money to his ultra-Orthodox Jewish coalition partners to ensure their support. Protesters said that Netanyahu is looting the public coffers to curry favor with extremist figures in his far-right cabinet. Under a last-minute deal with one of the ultra-Orthodox parties in Netanyahu's coalition, married ultra-Orthodox Jewish men will receive financial grants. This is in addition to other allocations traditionally made to such communities. The demonstration was organized by the same group of activists who have been protesting the cabinet's judicial overhaul plan since January. Those protests, which at times have turned violent, continue to draw thousands of protesters onto the streets every single week. Under pressure, Netanyahu has for the time being announced a pause to the plan, which his critics say, if approved, will strengthen his grip on power and weaken the regime's judiciary. Russia says it scrambled a fighter jet to intercept two U.S. bombers over the Baltic Sea amid simmering tensions between the two nuclear-armed powers. Russia's defense ministry says its fighter jet prevented violation of the country's border by U.S. Air Force strategic bombers. It added the mission was carried out according to strict international rules. The Pentagon has confirmed the incident, claiming bombers were taking part in a long-planned exercise over Europe. Now, this is not the first aerial confrontation between the two sides since the Ukraine war broke out last year. Back in March, a Russian jet approached a U.S. drone over the Black Sea, after which the drone crashed. Russia denied that its aircraft had caused that crash. Doctors at Emergency Center in Donetsk say that they keep receiving dozens of military personnel and civilians who suffered injuries caused by shelling from Ukrainian forces. Number of patients has significantly increased since more NATO weapons have been pumped into the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Our correspondent Max Chivili has your details from Donetsk.
Specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians was also a child. 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing the situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbas, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Chivili, Donetsk.
Russia has reiterated that it will achieve its intended goals in Ukraine through its ongoing special military operation there or by other available means. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has been quoted by a Russian news agency as saying that Moscow is taking under consideration only the completion of this operation in Ukraine. He said ensuring its interests is Russia's main objective. Peskov was responding to a question whether Russia will consider the possibility of freezing the conflict. He did not specify what other means Russia will take to achieve its objectives. The Kremlin has repeatedly said, though, its actions in Ukraine are aimed at defending Russia's security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. But Kiev and its Western allies have called Russia's operation an aggression. China has expressed eagerness to expand bilateral cooperation with Russia and take it to a new level. Chinese Premier Li Qiang said the two sides have so far shown good development and significantly increased number of investments. Li made the remarks while meeting with his visiting Russian counterpart Mikhail Mishustin. Two-day trip by Mishustin's aimed at signing a series of deals that, despite criticism from the West, which has been trying to pressure China to take a side in the Ukraine war and refrain from deepening ties with Moscow. But China has repeatedly made it clear it is free to collaborate with whoever it wants. The China-Russia trade increased by more than 100% in the past year. Mishustin has predicted bilateral trade turnover will reach $200 billion this year. U.S. stocks have taken a tumble amid concerns over uncertain negotiations aimed at avoiding a government debt default. On Tuesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid 0.7%, the S&P fell 1.1%, while the NASDAQ Composite dropped 1.3 percentage points. This as talks still continue between the White House and the House of Representatives. Negotiations seek to raise the government's borrowing limit, which currently stands at about $31.4 trillion. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is pressuring the White House to cut spending in the federal budget, but President Joe Biden is pushing for new taxes. U.S. is in for a crippling default as early as June 1st if Congress does not lift its debt ceiling. The default will leave millions of Americans without paychecks. It could also trigger a recession, destroying millions of jobs and businesses in the process. Hundreds of supporters of detained WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, including his family members, have staged a rally in the Australian city of Sydney demanding his release. The rally was scheduled to coincide with the U.S. president's visit to Sydney to attend the Quad Leaders Summit, but Joe Biden's trip was called off due to a crisis over the debt ceiling at home. Assange's family members thanked his supporters. Assange, an Australian citizen, was arrested in the UK in 2019 after Ecuador revoked his diplomatic asylum at its embassy in London, where he spent 7 years holed up. He is now battling extradition to the U.S., where he is wanted on criminal charges. Assange's WikiLeaks released some 700,000 classified military documents, which expose the U.S. government and its wrongdoings in Iraq and Afghanistan. Washington says release of the documents put American lives in danger. Strikes continue to take place throughout Europe, but in France, there is increasing talk of launching a second general strike in less than 4 years. The main bone of contention, the forcing through of a two-year increase to the retirement age by presidential decree. Rami Mazahari reports from Paris.
Across France, top unions led another day of strikes aimed at winning the revocation of a recent two-year hike to the retirement age. With President Emmanuel Macron refusing to budge, many are now demanding the movement expand into a complete general strike.
We must have a general strike to create a new system of society, as our current model allows the government and the bosses to totally ignore our needs. Everybody must get involved because everybody is affected.
Many speculate that Macron is so isolated from everyday French society that he may not understand how resentful the public mood is following one austerity measure after another since 2010.
Macron doesn't listen to us, but what's worse is that he looks down on us. He still doesn't care about all the protesting, so that's why our goal has to be to block the entire economy with a general strike. That will get his attention.
The general strike of 2019-2020 was the nation's longest labor action ever, but it ultimately failed. The strike shaved only 0.1% off of French economic growth that quarter, showing that a general strike's most powerful aspect may be its ability to shame and discredit those in power. The biggest economic impact of striking is felt by the workers. The pre-COVID general strike failed because so many workers were just too impoverished to continue a strike that had lasted almost 2 months.
The government did all it could to stretch the general strike out, as their plan was to exhaust the strikers financially. They're using the same tactic now, and that's why we saw more than 4 months of massive protests before they even met with unions to discuss the age hike.
This spring has seen record strikes in other European nations, such as Belgium, Germany, Spain, and even the United Kingdom. Low salaries, record inflation, and perceptions that their governments refuse to democratically recognize the scope of the hardship are all consistently cited as reasons. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. کتاب الله.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Liberation of Khorramshahr, day of resistance, self-sacrifice and victory. Of May was the day when the port city of Khorramshahr in southwestern Iran was liberated from Ba'athist occupation in 1982. This day has been named as a day of resistance, self-sacrifice and victory in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The history of the Holy Defense is full of great days which have remained in the minds and hearts of people with honor. But the day of liberation of the strategic port city of Khorramshahr is one of the greatest of such days, if not the greatest of them. The beautiful port city is located in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran. It was the scene of very hard resistance of the local people and selfless sacrifices of the forces who stood against the invading Iraqi Ba'athist army for 35 days with their bare hands until the port city fell on 26th of October 1980. However, Khorramshahr was freed from the clutches of the Ba'athist regime after 578 days. The port city of Khorramshahr was liberated through the cooperation of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, and the Iranian army. The liberation of the port city was the main goal of the fourth phase of the Beit al-Muqaddas operation. This operation put an end to 19 months of Ba'athist occupation of this most sensitive part of Khuzestan province. Yet the liberation of Khorramshahr was a very decisive blow to the Iraqi regime's war machine and the prestige of the Ba'athist regime. The liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr was so important that the founder of the Islamic Revolution, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, called it a divine grace and an extraordinary achievement. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has also called it a unique event in the world's history. The liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr is known as a turning point in the Iraq-Iran war. The Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein had boasted that if ever Iran took back the city, he would deliver the key to Basra to the Iranians. The liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr cost the Iraqi army very dearly, as over 16,000 of its forces were killed or injured, and more than 19,000 others were taken as captives. After the liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr, the valiant Iranian forces held congregational prayers at the Jame Mosque in the city of Khorramshahr, and the news of the liberation was broadcast everywhere in Iran, and the people rejoiced and they were exhilarated at hearing this great news. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, issued a message on the occasion of the liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr. The Imam said, "Thanks to the telegrams which were sent to me on the liberation of Khorramshahr, unbounded gratitude to Almighty God who granted his favour and support unto the Islamic country, and the devoted and selfless combatants, and bestowed this great victory on us." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has also commented on this occasion. The leader said, "When our armed forces started their move in the Beit al-Muqaddas operation, with prudence, clear insight, faith-based willpower, trust in God, using all facilities at their disposal and relying on their own force, and God the Exalted, no one in the world believed that they could liberate the port city of Khorramshahr. But that's actually what they did. When we announced that we had retaken the port city of Khorramshahr, the world's news agencies were hesitant and they did not want to broadcast this news for a couple of days. They were looking at it with doubt. But this event occurred and finally everyone was forced to admit this great victory for the Islamic Republic of Iran."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Information Society.
Part 1.
On April 18, 1943, Japanese Commander Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto left the Rabaul base in New Guinea for the Solomon Islands. It was Admiral's last flight. On his way to the island, 16 U.S. fighter jets appear in the sky and attack the Admiral. After the shooting, the plane wing falls apart and the Admiral's plane crashes in the woods. The question is, where did the planes come from? How was Yamamoto's direction revealed? The great discovery of the 19th century was the telegraph that spread all over the world like wildfire. After a while, Nikola Tesla raised the idea of global wireless communication system. But in 1914, the First World War broke out and the military projects were given priority. In the spring of 1917, America's cryptographic organization, the Black Chamber, was established and Herbert O. Yardley was designated head of the chamber. He was a telegrapher who learned cryptology from his father. Breaking codes was something easy for him. But using the telegraph companies, Yardley received all messages and decoded them. So the Americans had the upper hand in negotiations. The pinnacle of success in breaking codes is associated with Zimmermann, the German foreign minister. The incident has its roots in Iran. Wilhelm Wasmus, a German spy, was caught up in a bind in Iran, but he left some crucial documents and fled. Among those documents he left in Iran, there was a book of coding. The documents were transferred to room 40 in the UK and then to the US. So Germany's coding system was revealed. After a while, on January 16, 1917, Zimmermann's famous telegraph message was eavesdropped and decoded. Germany was trying to spur Mexico to get into a fight with the U.S. under the pretext of recapturing its land. The U.S. was looking for an excuse, so it grabbed the opportunity and declared war against Germany. In 1929, the U.S. Army's Signal Intelligence Service was secretly activated. Following that, Yardley's cryptology office was shut down. In 1931, the book The American Black Chamber was published and details of the chamber were revealed to the media. William Frederick Friedman was at the helm of the Signal Intelligence Service. A few years later, it managed to break the Japanese coding system, which led to Yamamoto's plane crash. In a group photo, they say in Morse code image that knowledge is power. In 1941, the German U-boat submarines pose a lot of danger. The UK turned to the US for help. The Atlantic Charter was issued 4 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. The US and Britain forged an alliance. In 1943, Washington and London signed the top secret BRUSA agreement to spy on Germany's telecommunication. Their eavesdropping networks were linked up, and hence, coding, influence, and breaking codes became more serious. Finally, ultimately, the confidential UK-USA Agreement on Intelligence Signaling was secretly implemented. Australia, Canada, and New Zealand joined the accord. The hot topic those days was mechanical systems for saving searchable data called MIMEX. The idea was proposed by the science deputy of Defense Minister Bush, who had a big role in making the atom bomb.
Point of 18 years, do you have any regrets about it?
No.
As the Second World War was drawing to a close, Roosevelt died and his deputy, Harry Truman, assumed power. 4 months later, Truman issued an order for an atomic attack on Japan so the World War could end with the U.S. display of power. Truman was seeking power. The liberated lands were war booties, and in his opinion, peace was an opportunity for the next war. For the U.S., the Soviet Union was a hostile force. Yesterday's comrade became today's foe. Following the strikes in the U.S., Truman asked for more authority in Congress and set the ground for the national security to control society. Things went in a way that the dreams of the Freemason president would be guaranteed. After the National Security Act was approved, different institutions were established, including the National Security Council. After Truman and the National Security Council's approval, on November 4, 1952, an organization was established which was named the National Security Agency, or the NSA. All of the constituents of the agency were confidential. They sometimes jokingly called it no such agency. In 1957, the NSA was transferred to Fort Meade, Maryland. And in 1969, no such agency had about 90,000 employees. Hence, Truman divided the U.S. along the lines of insiders and outsiders. Amid the heat of the security activities, the U.S. was caught up by surprise by the Soviet Union. Sputnik, the first artificial satellite in the world, was launched to the Earth's orbit by the Soviet Union.
This is really quite an advancement for not only the Russians, but for international science. I think we all agree on that.
The newspaper scared people and put the politicians under pressure. Eisenhower decided to fill the gap and spoke of setting up a headquarters. 4 days later, Defense Secretary Neil McElroy told Congress about creating an agency tasked with making missiles and space missions to repel the threat. The agency was named ARPA, or Advanced Research Projects Agency. The agency kicked off its activities under the management of Johnson from General Electric. Roy Johnson left his job as a CEO with a $160,000 salary and became manager of ARPA. ARPA's $520 million budget was approved. Engineers and genius staff who had been serving the U.S. after the Second World War formed ARPA's corpus, but not all of them were American. For example, in Alabama's Huntsville missile site, German engineer Wernher von Braun was making weapons that were badly needed by the Army. By the help of such people, ARPA led major projects to success, including Defender, Vela, and Agile. U.S. Army personnel who had secretly tested the hydrogen bomb were caught by surprise once again. The evidence of an atomic blast was found in Alaska. In response to the U.S., the Soviets tested their first bomb. The investigation revealed that they had made at least three atomic bombs. The radar systems in the U.S. were not connected, and they could have stopped working in an aerial attack. The airplanes that flew in a low altitude could easily enter the U.S. and do the job, a counterattack, or maybe a coup de grace. The solution was to connect radar systems and use the most advanced computer back then, the Whirlwind. So the Lincoln Lab was established. MIT assessed the Air Force's old plan, the Charles Project, an advanced warning network for defense in the face of a large-scale attack named SAGE. SAGE was a continental system based on 23 centers that could simultaneously trace 400 planes by using a more advanced computer named the FSQ. In 1962, Licklider, an MIT professor and author of Human-Computer Coexistence, who was looking for a really smart system, was hired by ARPA and was put in charge of the Information Processing Techniques Office, the IPTO.
The computer technology has been moving in a way that nothing else people have ever...
According to an instruction by the Department of Defense, ARPA was assigned with linking the main computers in Mount Shin, the Pentagon, and the Air Force headquarters. It was a fledgling agency which was run at a lower cost. The goal was the conceptual aspects of command and control programs for strategic aerial command. The agency was the main arm in airstrikes and was an important factor in missile attacks. The project funding was not a small amount, $5.8 million. In 1965, ARPA launched a project to create a real network. The technology was based on a theory by Paul Barron, breaking messages to smaller packages. After an extensive endeavor, finally, on October 29, 1969, efforts were made to link up the first two nodes and establish what was later named ARPANET. We typed the letter L and we asked, "Do you see the L?" They said yes. We typed O and asked, "Do you see the O?" And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. ARPANET expanded and the users could share information, but the management of the network wasn't handed over to the private sector because it was an achievement by ARPA, which was working under the Department of Defense, which had completely military priorities. In 1972, ARPA expanded its military activities and was renamed DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. In 1973, the first satellite network communication between California and Hawaii was set up, and it eventually reached London and Norway. The more ARPANET expanded, the harder it was to find out who was using it.
they couldn't figure out who was linked to the network. There was no supervision. On the other hand, the political situation was chaotic due to the Vietnam War, and it had affected the U.S. The opponents of the Vietnam War, like Muhammad Ali and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., were under watch.
I have a dream.
The combination of the fast expansion of the network and lack of control over the dissidents could turn into a serious national security threat. Militarism brought the expanding ARPANET under the control of the Department of Defense. The access was more limited than before. And after a while, MILNET, namely the Department of Defense's military network, was completed and was preferred over ARPANET. Telecommunications protocols were an important issue. ARPA's preferred model was definitely TCP/IP. The Europeans suggested the OSI model. ARPA was the winner. The Foundation of Science said using ARPA's model was obligatory. Granting the finance to establish university networks was conditional on using the TCP/IP model. The pretext was ARPA's model could recognize the saboteurs of networks more quickly. The network served as a new source of revenue for the U.S., and as the Department of Defense demanded, TCP/IP was established. At the same time, hidden layers emerged, so it was easier to recognize people who logged on to the network. In 1983, establishing a network by using smaller networks based on the telecommunications protocols of DARPA was defined. After the networks linked up, the internet came to existence. Identifying the computers in the network was an important issue, which was resolved with IP. Every system had a specific number. ICANN was created to protect the technical aspects and the DoD policies. ICANN, based in California, determined the name and number of computers on the internet. The identifiers included the names of domains, IP addresses, and many other parameters. The interesting point is the U.S. government is still the determiner of the names of domains on the internet and controls purchase of domains.
As most know, the internet grew out of U.S. government research, and ICANN grew out of a 1998 commitment by the U.S. government that would allow the private sector a leadership role in the management of the domain name system.
ARPA's progress in information technology would guarantee U.S. dominance. But the Department of Defense dreamed of more advanced products. Therefore, they decided to make a huge change in the telecommunication and computing industries by investing on the very large-scale integration, VLSI. By executing the program, stunning technologies came into being. The outcome was 24 different products that had a huge impact in DARPA's continued progress and Silicon Valley companies like Cisco, Adobe, and Sun. The synergy between DARPA, universities, and the market was a good business model. Everyone was at the service of DARPA, and DARPA was at the service of the U.S. Defense Department. The CIA's intelligence activities were forbidden on U.S. soil, but sometimes some terrifying news was spread about the activities of a secret agency that was spying on people. Efforts were made to reveal the secret. After a year of hard work, Perry Felwalk, in an interview with Ramparts magazine in 1972 under the pseudonym Winslow Peck, revealed that there's a large espionage agency whose funding was bigger than the CIA. The hiding giant was emerging, but such news stories weren't noticed. The Australian Prime Minister was not aware of his country's agreement with the U.S. for a long time. After Morphy laid into the Australian Security Intelligence Organization in 1973, the clandestine deal came to light. People didn't know that the Pine Gap Space Station in Alice Springs, which was supposed to be involved in space missions, had turned into a monitoring station based on a secret deal and was run by the CIA. There was a plot. It took James Bamford 10 years to blow the cover from a spying system in 1982. The most important revelations were made from within the spy station. Margaret Newsham, director of computer systems who had been working for Lockheed Martin in California for 10 years since 1974, was a coordinator of the NSA's classified software in Menwith Hill Station. Her task was to install and run some software named Echelon on Lockheed Martin computers. It was clear what the agency was doing, monitoring and spying. She blew the whistle because of corruption, defrauding, and personal abuses at the agency. According to Newsham, phone calls by Senator Strom Thurmond were consistently eavesdropped on by the NSA. The NSA, the so-called no such agency, was spying, and it has penetrated people's lives to such an extent it was aware of what they were doing. After a while, in 1996, Nicky Hagar, a journalist, in his book named The Secret Power, revealed New Zealand's role in the espionage network. Based on documents, the Australian and New Zealand governments had been involved in espionage for a while and were completely aware of the developments in East Asia. A year after the book was published, Hagar and John Campbell, in a courageous move, entered the YOP station while they were filming the incidents in the operations center.
And actually, there's no people there. The whole system can run itself.
In 1988, in an article titled Somebody's Listening, authored by Duncan Campbell, the nature of the spying activities came to light. He had been under watch by the British spy agency from 1976 for the revelations he made about the GCHQ. He had achieved more details. He revealed the roles played by the US, Britain, Australia, Germany, Japan, and their program within Project 415. The satellites were not launched into space to track missiles or for telecommunication purposes. They were used solely for spying. Echelon was done. Echelon had its roots in the Second World War to track Soviet waves based on an agreement named UK-USA. The two major projects back then were Transit to track Soviet satellite communication and Echelon to track global satellite telecommunications. From 1962, there was an expanded supervision, and Echelon was used against ordinary civilians as well. It was dangerous. The technical know-how to track communications was achieved by DARPA and the NSA. Ordinary emails, faxes, telexes, and telephone calls all over the world were being tracked, listened in, and logged. The important point was Echelon had targeted all governments, organizations, and even ordinary people. To bypass the law that prohibits surveillance on citizens, the US and Britain used a simple trick to spy on their own people. They were spying on each other's citizens and shared the results in the same computer. Echelon would single out the important keywords from among a large number of contacts and conversations. The keywords would include names, neighborhoods, subjects, and stuff like that that were significant for spy agencies. The important point was each country had its own list. For example, New Zealand didn't know which list the US would use to assess information that it received or who the subject of the surveillance would be. After Echelon, privacy was gone forever. After more revelations, more names surfaced. Shamrock, Project Minaret, Counterintelligence Operations, and Operation Chaos. The last one was the CIA and FBI special smear campaign against dissidents. It was different from the program that was launched against students. Echelon was picky. It used a specific program to spy on different groups in Washington, D.C. The revelations reached the embassies. Mike Frost was in charge of installing surveillance tools inside the embassies. He made some revelations.
Britain is now paying the price for its decision to leave the European Union. Guy Hans, British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma, says Britain will soon be poorer than Poland. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg wrote in this regard, Brexit has weakened the UK economy and driven the nation into a sort of geriatric decline. British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra